We welcome to the show Attorney General William Tong. Mr. Tong, welcome back. How are you?
It's cooled down here a bit, which is good.
That's true. Yes, it has. It's good to hear from you. Certainly a lot has gone on since the last time you came on, especially Stone Academy. I don't think I've had you on to talk about this since everything kind of unraveled in February. What's the very latest on this? I know your office has been very active in following this, which, you know, the closures certainly impacted over 800 nursing students here in Connecticut. What can you tell us?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is one of the worst cases of consumer fraud, frankly, that I've seen in my now going on 5 years as Attorney General. Hard to imagine. We've got actually close to 1,000 students who are stranded. And at the core of it here are the students. And the state, the Office of Higher Education, the State Department of Public Health are doing everything they can to help these students. But I won't sugarcoat it. They're in a really tough spot because essentially what Stone did was it lied to these students, sold them a total bill of goods in promising that they would have industry leading experts teaching them their classes, that they would prepare them to take the boards, basically the professional exam known as the NCLEX, and they'd be prepared to become licensed practical nurses. All of that was untrue for a lot of these students, the vast majority of them. And now you've got hundreds of students, upwards of 1,000, who are stranded. And so I've sued Stone for those lies using the state's consumer protection laws. I'm seeking millions of dollars in penalties and restitution. I want to get as much money as I can back to the students and to help them get back on their feet and continue their educations and realize their dreams of becoming nurses.
You know, let's talk a little bit about the fallout with this, Attorney General, because it seemed like Stone was really on the state's radar for quite some time. So why the abrupt closure? Why not have this happen before the semester got started, or why not finish out the semester? Why in February?
Yeah, good question. You can ask Stone. They haven't provided a good answer. Instead of doing the right thing, stepping forward, giving whatever money they have to take care of these students, and as part of this lawsuit, I'm seeking what's known as a prejudgment remedy, which means even before we get to trial, I want the court to seize all their assets, including the personal assets of one of the owners and the head of Stone, Joe Beerbohm, including his mansion in Rocky Hill. I mean, I want the court to take it all and put it into court and to have that there for students and for restitution and for penalties and fines. But, I don't know why they abruptly closed. And instead of making it right, they turned around and started blaming regulators, started blaming the state for asking questions. You know, the state did its job. Once it saw that there were problems, it started putting pressure on Stone to make it right. And it wasn't just the state of Connecticut. It was the U.S. Department of Education, putting them on monitoring, giving them notice they had to turn it around and start providing what they promised to the students or else. And that's what you would expect the state to do, to hold them accountable, to hold them responsible. And instead of doing better and improving the quality of the school and providing what they promised, they abruptly closed and shut down and basically pulled the rug out from under all of these students. And so they blame the state for shutting them down. That is so unbelievably false. We didn't shut them down. They themselves, on their own initiative, shut down and close the doors and shut all these students out when they felt the heat coming from the state.
I was going to say, I mean, it had to have been, the state I know had been investigating Stone Academy, and there were a lot of failures, it seems, from the paperwork on their part. It just seemed like, why not, before the fire got too hot, why not give these students an option? And so, like you said, not only do we have all these students kind of left high and dry, but the other side of this too, which I don't know if this is, you know, as much of a concern, but maybe it is. Are you worried about the students who have graduated, who have degrees from Stone Academy now out in the working world?
I'm worried about all of them, and I'm worried about the state's healthcare system. We need nurses. We need these students to complete their studies. We're still struggling to get out of a pandemic and get back on our feet. You know, that the effects of COVID are not over. I don't have to tell anybody that. So we need these nurses back in, well, we need these nurses in the workforce, and we need these students back in school. And for a major operator like Stone to shut down abruptly does incredible damage to these students, most of whom were looking for a second career, right? Most of whom were women, many women of color who probably would be, many of them were working one, two jobs on top of trying to complete their studies, doing it at night, doing it on the weekends, doing it while trying to keep a job or raise kids or raise a family. So the damage done to these students and their families is unconscionable.
Now, Stone Academy has said that it's been cooperating with the investigation, but it sounds like they're not.
No, they're anything but cooperative. And again, instead of putting their money where their mouth is and taking care of these students, they've launched a public relations and lobbying campaign against the state, trying to blame regulators. You know, the way I have analogized it is, it's as if somebody, is speeding, driving 100 miles an hour, and a trooper starts to pursue them, to pull them over, and then because they're driving so fast, they crash their car, and then they blame the trooper. I mean,
for causing the crash. Right. So my other question for you, Attorney General, before we change directions into another topic, at this point, you know, August of 2023, how many of those students that were Stone Academy students, I know that the state is working to give them some of their money back. They're trying to kind of, you know, put them into different programs, give them different options. How many of them are potentially either enrolled in something so they can hopefully get their degree maybe in the next year or so? Like, how many are somewhat settled at this point, or are the majority of them still kind of left saying, I have no idea what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I think that transcripts were recently shared and released with the students after a detailed audit of what happened at Stone. You would expect that to happen. We needed to get to the bottom of what happened with individual students and their credits. What's challenging is that everyone's differently situated, right? Everyone is at different points in their studies. They have earned different credits in different amounts. And so working through all of that takes time, and it's painstaking, and it's frustrating for everybody, but most of all the students. So we're trying to get people into programs where they can transfer and continue their careers and continue their studies. We're trying to help students who are closer to being done to get help in sitting for the exams and getting refreshers if they've been away from their books and their classes for an extended period of time. And then the students who had just started, getting them into a program where they can get back on a path to becoming licensed practical nurses.
We have Attorney General William Tong here. And we were just talking about Stone Academy, but I did want to talk about a couple of different stories as well. This was actually new in our news, Attorney General Tong, so I hope I'm not throwing you off too much. But I was reading this morning that you will not be representing a state prison guard facing a lawsuit over the death of an inmate going by the name of Lieutenant Carlos Padro. And it seems like he is the only one of the 12 defendants in the 2019 death of Robbie Talbot that you will not be representing. Why?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I have to make this decision from time to time. It's not the first time that I've made this decision, and I'm not the first attorney general to decline to represent a particular defendant. Most of the time, in almost every case, I represent the state officials, including elected officials and corrections officers and state police officers. And we take that responsibility very seriously, but in cases where a defendant has been accused of gross and wanton misconduct, where I think it is really not appropriate for the state to represent that defendant, then I make the decision not to represent them, and that's what happened here. And I obviously can't comment more because the case is pending. But it's a decision that unfortunately is entrusted to one person. That's me. And I have to make that call from time to time.
Okay. And let's talk about the latest maybe scams, or I know I've had you on several times talking about TikTok bad trends. Is there anything on the state's radar that they are concerned about or that's come up in recent weeks that you want to let the public know?
In terms of TikTok, you're saying?
Could be TikTok, could be bad scams. I know right now there are scams going around.
There's so much to say.
You know, right. You like know? Any, I mean, I guess like what you're most concerned about, I know we've been covering a lot. There's, you know, we have the Better Business Bureau on a lot to talk about like senior scams and credit card scams, things like that. But anything that's kind of popped up recently.
Yeah. So what I've learned again after now almost 5 years as Attorney General is that, and not to poke too much fun at it because it's not funny, but there seems to be a scam for everyone, right? It's scammers are not short on creativity, and they can move quickly because running a scam is cheap and it's easy. You know, phone, line, internet, all that doesn't cost very much. Lately there have been targeted scams, for example, of student loan borrowers after the Supreme Court's decision in Biden versus Nebraska, in which the Supreme Court essentially blocked President Biden's plan to provide relief to millions of American student loan borrowers. People started getting calls if you have student loans, and I still have student loans. People were getting calls saying, actually, there's been a big settlement. And if you give us, you know, personal information, bank account information, Social Security information, we'll get you some money. Or actually, we have a special student loan forgiveness program that a lot of people don't know about. Again, give us your federal student loan ID information. Give us sensitive personal information and we'll get you some money. And I don't have to tell you why they want that information. It's so they can access bank accounts and commit identity theft. So that's awful, of course. And if you're facing, you know, restarting your student loan payments when maybe you really can't afford to do that, this is a very scary proposition for a lot of people. Yeah. And if somebody calls you and offers you relief, that can be very attractive. So don't fall for that. Nobody's going to call you and offer you a student loan forgiveness plan. Don't give any of that information on the phone. And whatever you do, don't give your Social Security number or your credit card information.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other scam that really bothers me is scams against people in the military, active duty, and veterans. I busted and went after a jewelry chain that set up shop outside of bases and would get essentially unwitting soldiers, a lot of young soldiers, 18-year-old, right, 19-year-old kids who you know, wanted to buy a piece of jewelry for someone at home, a loved one, significant other, maybe get an engagement ring, when they couldn't afford it, right? And so this chain, Harris Jewelers, would set up shop and promise that you could buy this expensive engagement ring and then charge you unbelievably high interest rates and just take advantage of these service people.
That's disgusting.
So that's one scam. And so there are a lot of scams that target people in the military and soldiers, and I encourage everyone to be careful about that.
Yeah, that's literally atrocious. I can't even believe it. I can believe
it's
it,
atrocious.
But that's horrific.
Why I said there seems to be a scam for everybody.
You know,
it's just like there's no shortage of schemes.
That's true. I mean, if they could only use their smarts for good, my gosh, how much better we would be off.
Yes, right.
One more question for you, Attorney General, before you go. I know in the beginning of the summer, you had launched an investigation into Hyundai and Kia. And I know that Senator Blumenthal, I think just again last week, was calling for a national recall of these models because of the TikTok trend where people can just, you know, hotwire these cars and they can get away. And we're seeing a huge increase in car theft, specifically those models certainly really being targeted. Has anything come out of your open investigation?
We're very aggressive in our investigation. There's no resolution yet. I can't tell you that that Hyundai and Kia have stepped forward and said, you know what, you're right, we're going to fix this problem. They haven't done that. And what's really tough for people in Connecticut is that a lot of people own these cars, and you expect in this day and age that there is basic anti-theft, right, theft deterrent technology in these cars. But as you can see online at TikTok or at other places, YouTube, it can be easy to hotwire these cars. And we're showing our age a little bit, or at least I am. And I can remember TV shows where, you know, an old cop show like Starsky and Hutch or something would be very easy for somebody to jump in a car, use a screwdriver, and steal a car in less than 60 seconds. I think a lot of people thought that maybe that wasn't possible anymore because of the advanced nature of our automobiles, except it is still possible mm-hmm. with Hyundais and Kias. And they, you know, what they're offering to some people is, oh, we'll give you a club, right? One of those steering wheel.
Like the locks. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, I mean, what is this, 1992? I mean,
I don't know why you wouldn't recall. I mean, I understand it's a financial thing, but it's like, come on, just recall the vehicles at this point. I don't know why they're not. Yeah.
Give me a break. Don't give me a club that people are using before the turn of the century.
I don't disagree. Well, Attorney General, I really appreciate you coming on, talking about a lot of different topics, and it's great to be able to check in with you. I thank you for your time, and I look forward to having you back on really soon.
Yeah, it's been too long. Talk soon.
All right. Attorney General William Tong right here on WACC. Depression is a common and serious illness. In fact, a CDC study shows that about 1 in 10 women in the United States report symptoms that suggest they have experienced or are experiencing an episode of major depression in just the last year. And when you look at the Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, CDC research shows about 1 in 8 women with a recent live birth experience symptoms will show that they have gone through or are currently dealing with postpartum depression. It is more common than I think people realize. And we want to talk about the importance of postpartum depression. Where does that come from? Why do women experience this after giving birth? And of course, the huge news this month that the FDA has just approved a pill that could be available as early as October to deal with postpartum. And so we have back on the show with us Dr. Daniel Gotchel with Hartford Healthcare. He is the Vice President of Medical Affairs for the Fairfield region, also a practicing OBGYN, and he delivers at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Dr. Gotchel, thank you for your time. So glad to have you back on the show. How are you?
I'm well, and I have a patient in labor this morning, so thanks for mentioning that.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. Everything went okay? Dr. Gotchel, did I lose you already? I know you're in the hospital, so I know the service can be a little wonky.
Can you hear me?
Oh, good. Yes, I can hear you. everything went okay with your patient this morning?
Everything's going great.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. God bless. I'm so glad to hear that. Let's talk about postpartum. Why is it that women experience postpartum more often than they don't?
Well, I mean, I think, like you said, thank you for sharing the numbers. And I think the fact that this new medication is coming out gives us an opportunity to kind of spread some light on this topic that, like you mentioned, people don't necessarily realize. I mean, it is as high as, you know, 1 in 7 women can have either, you know, issues with their moods after having a baby that becomes severe. And nobody really knows the exact reason. But for those of you that have had babies or know people that have had babies, you certainly understand the life changes that occur, certainly from the lack of sleep, being responsible for another human being, the changes in your relationships, your timing. But also, you know, imagine just there's a great deal of changes in the hormones and the neurotransmitters that are affected by that can affect some women more seriously than others.
Are there people that are more at risk, Dr. Gotchel, or are there things that women could do to avoid going through postpartum, or not really?
Well, I mean, I think there certainly are risk factors, and I think anybody that's had a history of decreased moods or anxiety in their lifetime may be more predisposed to this during the postpartum period, but there's not really a lot that anybody can do to prevent it except be aware of it, make sure that you let your healthcare providers kind of be clued into your history so that at the first signs that, you know, things aren't going the way you expect them to, that you reach out for help.
How do you know that you're experiencing postpartum versus just being really tired, or maybe you had a traumatic birthing experience and that's kind of just overwhelming you? Like, the, just as you mentioned, the adjustment of going from just you to now you handling another human life. How do you know it's postpartum versus just adjusting?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing you should know is that, you know, all of us in Women's Health, certainly Women's Health Connecticut, we test everybody. So everybody that comes in after they're having a baby goes through this formal, what's called the Edinburgh postpartum screening. So we actually have you fill out just a one-page questionnaire, and it asks questions like, you know, are things still making you happy? Are you sleeping? Do you ever feel really sad? Do you ever feel like hurting yourself? Do you ever feel like hurting anybody else? So really, for most people, it's the fact that, you know, real depression symptoms, so either tired all the time, really not feeling like themselves, really decreased mood, nothing giving them joy. You know, they're just, you just had a brand new baby. It should be a very exciting time in your life, and you're just not feeling that, inability to be able to really bond with a newborn. So there's a whole host of questions. But really, the key for people is that they're just, if they noticing, yeah, everybody has some decreased moods because of, you know, fatigue, et cetera. But if it's worse than that, then people should just not ignore it, and they should reach out to their healthcare providers.
I'm curious. We're talking to Dr. Gottschall this morning about postpartum, and he is the Vice President of Medical Affairs for the Fairfield region, also a practicing OBGYN who actually delivers and just did this morning at St. Vincent's Medical Center. Is that assessment, that one-page assessment, is that required at all hospitals across the country, or is that something specifically Connecticut Women's have made a priority to have done for everybody? Who's delivered recently?
So we're doing it. It's become a best practice recommended by the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. So I can't tell you specifically if everyone's following those best practices, but it has been the recommendation of our governing body to do that, certainly at the 4 to 6 week range. So most of the time, we're defining postpartum depression really as these decreased moods that occur really, you know, between 3 and 6 weeks after the baby. I mean, if it's, you know, much longer than that, then there'd be maybe some underlying other mood issues. But regardless of what we're calling it, it should be something that should be evaluated so that you see a healthcare professional, whether it's your OBGYN, your internal medicine doctor, or if you have, you know, a therapist, so they can do a thorough evaluation and screen, and then there's opportunities for therapy.
Yeah, the reason I asked that, Dr. Gottschall, is because I know for a fact it was not done, at least 5 years ago when I had my son, it was not done in the state of Vermont. I was never evaluated. And in fact, I found out, you know, months down the road that, in fact, I was like full blown postpartum. But I had no idea. I had never experienced something like that. And I'm usually a very happy go lucky kind of person. So to have such a drastic change in my mood and this almost like resentment towards my son and my family, it was just a very weird place to be in. I had never experienced anything like that before. And I remember like 6 weeks post, you know, having the baby, I was never given an evaluation. It was just kind of like, we checked the vitals of the baby. How's he doing? How are you in a health, like physically doing? And that was kind of it. It was pretty alarming to me. So I guess my question, the reason I asked that is because if you have somebody who, you know, if there are people out there who have, you know, children who are having kids soon that live in other states, what would you recommend they do to make sure that they are screening? Like, can they ask for a screening, or can they, you know, is there something that they can request if they don't live in the state of Connecticut?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the practical reality, we've been doing this, you know, in our practice for more than 10 years. Some practices are a little bit late to the game, and it's not necessarily per state, but it can be just based on the practitioner's ability to keep up. I'm pretty confident that all of our colleagues here in Connecticut, and certainly those of us that are participating in our women's health group across the state, are practicing these standard guidelines. But yes, you could certainly ask your doctor, and I think, you know, it's worthwhile bringing it up. you know, there's certainly tools online. All you have to do is put in, you know, postpartum depression, and you can find the you know, basics about what to look for. So there should be ways that people can educate themselves. And like I said, the most important thing is if there's just, like you said, if you're just not feeling the way you think you should, whether it's physically or emotionally, then it's time to bring that to your healthcare worker so they can help you figure out what the issues are and get you on the track to recovery.
We've been talking about postpartum depression. It's very common among women who just gave birth. And so we're talking today to Dr. Daniel Gonchel with Hartford Healthcare, Vice President of Medical Affairs for the Fairfield region, also a practicing OBGYN who delivers at St. Vincent's Medical Center. In fact, just before he came on the show, he delivered a baby, which is pretty incredible. Talk about just doing a million jobs at once, having a lot of hats on. That's for sure. Dr. Gonchel, we appreciate your time. Now, let's talk about the FDA just approved a postpartum pill earlier this month, and it can be available as early as October. What do you know about this pill?
Well, we're learning like everybody else, but you know, the really nice thing, the name of it is, I think it's pronounced Zurzuvae. The benefit of this drug and the mechanism of action is, I mean, it basically it works on, you know, the receptors in the brain. The real exciting thing is that, you know, the classic drugs that we've been using for decreased mood or depression and anxiety, you know, the Prozac-type drugs are the classic ones. They work, but they usually take a long time. They have to kind of build up into your system to affect what we call the neurotransmitters that really are what impact how people feel. And that could take 4 to 6 weeks or longer. The studies that come out with this medication is that really within the first few doses, and it's a pill that you take daily, you know, can have a meaningful effect so that people can really get some benefit much sooner than they've been able to. And as you know, as someone who's had a baby, you know, every day, every hour can really matter when you're not only caring for yourself and usually your family, but a new person who depends on you.
I'm curious, is this a kind of pill where, like, the thing I always worry about with medication when you're dealing with depression is weaning off of it? How do you know with postpartum, it can vary for people? How do you know when to start weaning off of a postpartum medication?
Yeah, I mean, I think for, you know, if you're taking a medication like this, classically in our practice, you know, we would really recommend that you work very closely with someone that is a specialist in behavioral health. So that, you know, it's not just your obstetrician managing this. We may be able to start you on this medication after we make that screening and potentially that diagnosis. But, you know, getting you involved and making sure that a professional healthcare worker, whether it's a psychologist or a psychiatrist, you know, stays really closely and then sees how you can actually make that transition. It's a great question, and there's no easy answer.
Mm. Dr. Gonchel, I'm curious, before this pill comes on the market in October, I don't know, have they ever had a postpartum pill on the market? I guess that would be my first question.
So that's a great question. There hasn't been a pill. There's been like an IV infusion that's given. So there is medication but because it's much more difficult to get into people and, you know, it's much more involved than just, you know, the doctor prescribing it and you're taking a pill, it's not really as widely used or certainly even, as you said, advertised. A lot of people don't even know about it. So, no, this is potentially revolutionary.
So my question following up with that one is, if people are not comfortable taking a medication for postpartum, what has been the professional suggestion for people dealing with postpartum? Like, are there things that they should be doing or things that they could take? Are there supplements? Like, what do you suggest to people who are struggling with postpartum depression right now?
So, I mean, classic behavioral health usually is a combination of certainly, you know, behavioral health counseling. And certainly we're a big believer in that. And for a lot of folks, you know, that's a real option to get with, you know, someone who's trained to do this, who's going to, you know, go through and work on different coping mechanisms with different people so that they can kind of work through this both from the counseling point of view and then, if it's necessary, medications. As far as complementary alternatives, there's been a lot of things out there, but no definitive studies that I would recommend that you go get X or Y. I think when we have someone in our practice that we're concerned about, you know, the first thing we try and do is get them to a behavioral health specialist that can really, you know, work through this. The test that we're talking about, that screening test, it's just that. I mean, it really doesn't necessarily make a diagnosis. It certainly screens people. But we try and work very closely with our behavioral health experts to make sure that our patients get the very best care.
And again, this medication, I believe, is called Zurzuvae, and it can be out on the market as early as October. Dr. Gottschall, from the early findings of this and the early research that you've done, do you believe it's something you'll be prescribing to patients or you'll recommend?
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, like I said, you know, this can be devastating for not only women, but their families and their children. We've seen all kinds of terrible events with people that have severe postpartum depression, right? It can affect moms. It can affect their relationships. It can affect their ability to be able to care for their babies. So that's why we're screening people and making sure that we're not missing this. And then at the very earliest signs, then being able to refer or even prescribe and refer. Because, you know, one of the opportunities I think that most people have seen in this state and others is that, you know, getting people in to see these trained behavioral health specialists is not as easy as we would like it to be. We're constantly working at that at Hartford Healthcare, and we have a very robust behavioral health program. But like in all types of medicine, sometimes getting access is the most important thing. And we're proud of our opportunities at Hartford Healthcare and certainly St. Vincent's. But this is an opportunity for us to start a medication and then refer and make sure that there's no gaps and delays.
Dr. Gottschall, I really appreciate you talking us through this and for just discussing postpartum in general. And I look forward to having you back on the show, I'm sure, in the near future and seeing what the future looks like with this new postpartum depression pill. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me again, Melissa.
Yeah, of course. And like I said, Dr. Gottschall literally just delivered a baby like just before coming on here. So it's pretty impressive. The guy just doesn't stop and he gets a whole lot done. We appreciate his time here on WACC. That's Dr. Daniel Gottschall here on Melissa in the Morning. In our everyday lives, it seems like the internet is part of it, right? Whether it's getting on your cell phone or logging into the internet on your tablet or even on your computer at work, it's an everyday occurrence. But unfortunately, not all seniors are connected to the internet. In fact, research shows that about 40% of U.S. seniors lack access to high-speed home internet services. And not only does that block them from getting access to better news, information, and resources that they may need, but also even just connecting them to family and friends. And today is National Senior Citizens Day, which makes it the perfect opportunity to talk about getting seniors a little more tech savvy. And who better to talk to than savvy senior syndicated columnist Jim Miller to talk about the digital divide and how to get seniors more comfortable with getting online. Jim, welcome to WICC. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Great to be with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's start out with talking about the digital divide. It became very apparent, especially during the pandemic. Could you maybe talk a little bit about what that means and how people were impacted by the digital divide?
Yeah, so COVID, like you said, really did expose the digital divide when most Americans were living online. You know, back when the pandemic hit, people that had high-speed internet and had the skills to be able to maneuver the web, those people did okay. I mean, they could still work remotely, or they could go to school, they could chat with their family and friends, or they could even have their groceries delivered to their house and buy them online. So they did all right. But for those people, that segment of the population that didn't have high-speed internet or didn't have those skills, they struggled a lot more. They were isolated. They were left alone. They just didn't do as well, and it became very prominent during the pandemic. So I'm really happy to be working with Cox, who's helping close that digital divide. Cox has been working with the federal government to expand the Affordable Connectivity Program so all Americans can have access to high-speed internet services.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. How does the Affordable Connectivity Program help families, and who is eligible for it?
Yeah, so the Affordable Connectivity Program, it also stands for the ACP, is a federal benefit that provides a $30 subsidy that can be applied to your internet cost. So, for example, if you're paying, say, $60 for your internet and you're eligible for the ACP, you can apply that $30 subsidy to your $60 fee and get your cost cut in half. Now, who's eligible for the ACP? You either have to be receiving some type of a government assistance program like SNAP, which is stands for food stamps, SSI, or Medicaid, or your income needs to be below the 200% poverty level. So, for example, for that, a family of two, your income would need to be slightly below $40,000 to be eligible, or a family of four, your income would need to be a little below $60,000 to be eligible. And Cox has the perfect plan that fits in with the ACP. The plan is called Connect Assist, which is a high-speed internet service that costs only $30. So if you're eligible for the ACP, you could apply your $30 subsidy to your Connect Assist plan, and you pay nothing at all for your internet cost.
Now, I was going to say that, which is a huge deal because high-speed internet can be really expensive. Let's talk specifically about mobile service. I was curious. I can't remember the last time, Jim, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong. I can't remember the last time I've seen a flip phone out there. I would imagine that a lot of seniors use smartphones today. Would you agree?
You know, the numbers have gone up a lot. According to the Pew Research Center, the most recent statistics has a little over 60% of people over the age of 65 have a smartphone, which has grown a lot. Just 5 years ago, it was 46% that had them. And 10 years ago, it was only 13%. So the numbers have gone way up for it. But affordability is probably the biggest thing, so we can get those numbers to go up. You know, Cox recently launched a new 5G mobile service available to Cox Internet customers with prices starting as low as $15 per month. So anyone that qualifies for the ACP can actually get their Cox home internet and their Cox mobile combined for as little as $15 per month. So that's pretty cheap. It's about as low as you're going to be able to get both services like that.
So we're talking to Jim Miller, who is the Savvy Senior Syndicated columnist, and we're talking about getting older adults connected to the internet. Before we continue on, though, Jim, can you kind of reiterate the importance of seniors getting online? I would imagine there are going to be people who are listening who think, okay, $15 a month, I can do that, and that would be great. But there are others who are going to say, why does it matter? Do I really need smart devices to feel like I'm in the know or to stay connected to my loved ones? What would you say?
Well, we know from a lot of different surveys and studies that seniors that are online are more connected to their community, they're more informed, and they're more independent. And, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And a lot of people, they just don't think they need it because they've lived their whole lives without it. But it opens up a whole new variety of opportunities for you to be able to stay more informed with news and information that's updated. Connect with family and friends, you know, find out about products and services that are available to you, you know, play games, research health topics, which is a very big thing for a lot of older adults, research doctors, medications, all of that. So it opens up this whole variety of a new world that you don't know that you're missing out on. And also, too, in today's world, it's a do-it-yourself world. A lot of places steer people to the website, like most seniors are Social Security beneficiaries or Medicare beneficiaries. Those two programs are steering everybody to their websites to be able to sign up and get their questions answered. So if you don't have access to the internet and the skills to be able to maneuver it somewhat anyway, then you're going to miss out on a lot of things that you don't even know about. So that's what I would say about that.
And Jim, if there are people listening this morning and this just all sounds very overwhelming to them, where can seniors go if they need help getting connected?
You know, I always tell people a great place to start is your family, you know, your children, or better yet, your grandchildren who live in the digital world. If that's not available to you or you're uncomfortable with that, there's resources in your community, your local public library, community colleges, computer stores, senior centers. A lot of these places have technology classes that are geared towards older adults that are terrific resources. They can tell you about what's available in your community as well. And there's also senior organizations like OASIS, who has classes online through OASIS Everywhere that you can get help. So there's lots of different places that you can get help for technology and find out about the services available to you.
And is there a website or anything else that people should know if they want more information about all of this?
Right. So to find out more about the Affordable Connectivity Program or the Connect Assist Plan that we talked about earlier, or to find out if you're eligible, just go to cox.com/digital equity, or you can just go to any Cox store in your community, and they'll be able to tell you about the services available there as well.
Well, Jim Miller, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to outline all of this for us and really helping us to understand the importance of getting seniors better connected to the internet. So thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Absolutely. Again, Jim Miller is the columnist for Savvy Senior. In fact, he's the syndicated columnist for that and an advocate for older adults right here on WICC, an expert on senior issues and, again, creator of the Savvy Senior column. We thank you for your resources this morning.